When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, Joe Martucci here, and this podcast is proudly sponsored by Weather Call Services. Don't be caught off guard by severe weather. Choose Weather Call.
Hello once again, everybody. I'm meteorologist Sean Sublitz, and welcome to Across the Sky, our national Lee Enterprises weather podcast. Lee Enterprises has digital and print news operations in more than 70 locations across the country, including in my home base in Richmond, Virginia. I'm joined this week by meteorologist Matt Hollander in our Chicago office. Kirsten Lang and Joe Martucci are out this week, and they're going to be disappointed, Matt, because we have a great guest this week. But before we get to that, Matt, you were telling me about how much you enjoy summers now in Chicago versus your native Texas. Now, why is that again, Matt?
I got to tell you, summer in Chicago versus Texas are two different worlds. I mean, people are so happy to be outside in the summer in Chicago. And it is completely the opposite. The way people react to summer weather in Chicago, just so different from Texas. Texas, there's so much talk of negativity about, oh, it's so hot. No, I'm not going to do anything in the afternoon. No, we're not doing anything in the afternoon. It is too darn hot. We're waiting until the sun sets. Not in Chicago. Everybody's like, yeah, what are we doing this afternoon? It's in the 80s. It's not 100 degrees. You know, that's the thing. In Chicago, people complain when it's in the 90s. I mean, in Texas, it's absolutely every day is going to be the 90s. And now more and more days are in the triple digits. So it's just a little bit cooler. You go farther north. And it's just for anybody who's only lived in Texas, you come up to Chicago in the summer, you're going to have a changed experience and you're going to have a new appreciation from summer. That said, it's the opposite in winter. And I do miss my Texas winters. They were a little bit more mild. But in my mind, Chicago makes up for it in summer. It is absolutely spectacular.
That is the goal. Texas during the winter and Chicago during the summer. But, you know, with the heat and the talk of, you know, climate change, climate warming, and Earth Day now, we went a little deeper. We made contact with Bill Weir, the chief climate correspondent at CNN. After he moved from a world of sports reporting, he has now taken on an environmental beat, written his experiences in a new book called Life as We Know It Can Be, Stories of People, Climate, and Hope in a Changing World. We talk with him about this change in direction in his career and how it has affected him, why he wrote this book in the first place, and why he kind of, you know, directly addresses his young children for some time down the road, and importantly, why storytelling is so critical when trying to convey a message. So with that, here is our conversation with CNN's Bill Weir. Bill Weir, thank you so much for joining us on the Across the Sky podcast. I know it's busy with the book out, so thanks so much for taking the time with us.
No, thank you, fellas. It's an honor to be with you. I can't wait to talk.
Yeah, so let's get into this book. It is deep, man. I mean, you see all these climate books that are out there, but this is deep, a history of civilization, what we've done well, not so well, physical needs, safety needs, all these things. So let me ask you, first off, why did you take this kind of a deep approach to the book?
Well, it started when my little boy was born at the height of the pandemic in 2020. I was a new old dad at age 52. My daughter at that time was 16. So I had a whole new perspective as a parent. I had a whole new perspective on planet Earth because I'd been covering climate full time for a few years. I had done my show, The Wonder List, which was inspired by my daughter. I used my kids as sort of breathing units of measurement for time, you know, and lifetimes, especially when my daughter realized she's going to turn my age in the year 2050. And so I said, I want to go visit the wonders of the world and what will be left of them for Olivia. And so I got to see the best of sort of human nature and civilization through that job. But I'd been covering a lot of grim stuff, a lot of disasters, and the politics around it is just so depressing. And so I started writing these Earth Day sort of cathartic letters of record to him as to what was going on, like outside the window as I'm feeding him at night. The world is in lockdown. And then I went to cover the George Floyd protests and then the politics of that election year in 2020. And I really saw it as a project to figure out how this kid should live. This kid is going to see the 22nd century. And at the current rates of change per lifetime is going, you know, where should he live? Is there a haven? What kind of house should he live in? What will be his energy supply, food supply? And in searching for answers to those practical questions, I met so many inspiring people and ideas who are trying to sort out these just planetary emergencies, some at the local scale, some in big systematic change ways. Legislation passed that uncorked all of this new private investment. So I was talking to entrepreneurs and venture capital guys about new ideas in thermal battery storage. And you see when suddenly Texas is the greenest state in the country because, you know, wind and solar are so cheap now, and despite the politics of it all. And so in the end, I was supposed to turn this book in 2 years ago, and I'm glad I didn't, because it would have been a lot darker, honestly. And sort of the best advice I got for covering climate came from Mr. Rogers, who said when he saw scary events on TV as a kid, his mom would say, look for the helpers. There's always helpers. And now I meet so many of these people, you know, rushing into disasters. But now I'm meeting all these other helpers who are in, you know, Silicon Valley, or they're in, you know, the Plain States trying to generate wind storage, you know, or a woman, of NFL mom I met, who's from the Pacific Northwest. After her first hurricane, when her husband retired and they settled in the Gulf Coast, she was a new mom, and it rattled her so much. She started a company to build disaster-proof construction. She imported this idea from Italy and wants to completely revolutionize the way you build homes in disaster zones that will last 200 years. And just, she's an outsider questioning the status quo and the groupthink in that area. And so you meet these folks, and in the end, I thankfully have more wonder than worry. I think we're capable of such amazing things. But worst case scenario, I want my boy to connect with the people and the nature around him and fortify that place and make that a better neighborhood for his presence, come what may, you know, whatever it's fire or flood. Now is the time to really start building not just infrastructures physical for the new world, but infrastructures of trust in each other.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. There's so much doom and gloom out there. And I think, like you, I worry that that's the message that gets out there and gets amplified. And while it is very important that we understand the criticality of what's going on, there is certainly room for optimism. I saw your discussion with Christiane Amanpour about this, and she asked you, do you think there should be more positive stories? And your face just lit up. So talk more about the positive things that are out there and why it's important to latch on to these positive stories, in addition to understanding and realizing that we are still in a bit of a pickle.
Absolutely. I think we have to be clear-eyed about the challenge and understand this is going to be tough. This is the point in the movie where you look around and like, some of us are not coming back from this, you know, but we're going in, and what's the best tools we have to tackle it? I had to ask my audience for a while to imagine a better future, but the technology just wasn't there yet. And I've done stories, and I talk in the book about visiting nuclear fusion labs where they're trying to crack the power of stars on Earth and create suns and boxes and abundant energy, you know, with the fuel coming from seawater, basically. No waste, no meltdown, safe enough you can blow it out like a match. But my kid's probably going to be a granddad before you can plug your appliances into that kind of energy. But the miracle that's already happened is after 150 years of human development, of us burning whatever was cheap and handy, whether it was dung or whales or trees or kerosene or coal, now the two cheapest forms of energy are sun plus storage and onshore wind. And that's why Texas is so green, and it's going to create a whole new industrial belt, the way that the factories of the last industrial revolution went to, you know, around the Great Lakes. Now factories that can run on clean energy will move to the wind and sun states. And when I was riding out Hurricane Ian, which is the most expensive hurricane to hit Florida, I was in Punta Gorda, and Everett counties around me just were in the dark, flooded, disastrous. We're about 12 miles inland. There was a community there where the lights never went out and they never flooded. First solar town in America, built by a former NFL lineman named Sid Kitson, who was an environmentalist and wanted to develop something in harmony with nature. Bought almost 100,000 acres of this ranch that had been largely left intact, gave most of it back to the state as a preserve, and then built with the natural water flows and built and made it 100% solar. And now there's proof this thing, you know, not a lick of damage in this hurricane, never lost power. And now the line to get a house in Babcock Ranch is, you know, you got to get in line, and they're building them as fast as they can. So there's a better story there. And it doesn't matter what your politics are. Maybe you just want to live in the place that doesn't go dark in a hurricane, and you can be a haven for the people who are in the dark and flooded for weeks, you know, and your schools are open and you are a source of strength. And so when I say we're all like a product of stories, right? Like one of my favorite examples is I grew up with the story that to show somebody I really love them, I had to spend 3 months' salary on a diamond, because diamonds are forever and they're rare and precious. When in fact, there are gigatons of diamonds on the ground and in vaults, and they rain on other planets. What's super rare, the rarest substance in the known universe, is wood, is a tree. And the ecosystems that are in harmony around us took just unfathomable amounts of billions of years to settle into place. And if we're not careful, we can wreck the joint, you know, in a couple of lifetimes. And so I think people are waking up to that. I hope they are. And nature has an amazing capacity to bounce back if given the space. And I focus on the helpers when I'm glum, but there are still dark days, you know, there are still dark days.
And Bill, before we go any farther, I just want to hit on your background, because it looks like you have a very interesting career path. So you started in local news, but then actually quit after a while to pursue stand-up comedy. But next thing you know, you're on ABC News, then going to CNN, and then becoming their chief climate correspondent. So can you walk us through your career path? Because it seems like a great story.
Yes, it's very traditional. Here's how you do it, kids. First, you start in Austin, Minnesota, doing weekend sports. I came out of college. I fell in love with sort of broadcasting and communication in school. I love newspapers. I love magazines. And at a certain point, I came out of school, I just said, I want to be on TV. And my heroes at the time were David Letterman and Peter Jennings. And I went the Letterman-esque way and became, I thought, I'll be a sportscaster, because I love sports. I love the culture around it. I could be funny and creative in that space. And in my first job, and I sent out 100 resume tapes to markets large and small, never, you know, nothing, not even a rejection letter. One day, my early, you know, 1991 cell phone rings. It was this big walkie-talkie, and the voice goes, "This is Brent Pickard. I'm the news director in Austin." And I thought, Austin, amazing, college town, barbecue, Ann Richards. And you're like, no, Austin, Minnesota, which I didn't know existed, and is on the Iowa border, and is a little town about 20,000, is where the SPAM headquarters are, the Hormel meatpacking plant. And he's like, I can't afford anybody to fly in for an interview. Is there any way you're going to be in the neighborhood? I said, I'll be there tomorrow. I will be there tomorrow. And they offered me $12,000 a year to do weekend sports and general assignment. But that first year, the World Series, Super Bowl, Final Four, when Duke beat Michigan Fab Five, U.S. Open, Stanley Cup were all in the Twin Cities. And I got to cut my teeth on these big events, get a cool tape together, and then go to Green Bay was the next stop. And then I went to Chicago, and there was a morning show there I did, and was the courtside reporter for the Bulls' last three championship runs. And my tape there, the morning show, was so non-traditional. I had another great killer resume tape. And that got me attention from the networks. Good Morning, you know, ABC at the time. I auditioned for The Daily Show when Craig Kilborn was leaving, and Jon Stewart hadn't accepted the job yet. And while all that was happening, two ABC stations in California, in San Francisco and LA, they both needed sports guys and had a little bidding war. And so I went to LA with the hopes of having a late night show, but never got that, and just got frustrated. And when they sent me home for 9/11, kind of the novelty had worn off. I didn't care about the standings in the National League West anymore. And I thought, I don't have a path back to legitimate news and to chase Peter Jennings, my other hero. So I'll go into Hollywood. I was, you know, had friends who were actors and screenwriters. And so I had a screenplay that I sold and did some pilots, and they'd send me on auditions. And I did some improv and stand up because I love that world. But one day when I was at an audition for a half hour comedy, a bunch of guys in a room waiting desperately, and in walks this guy with a fruit basket, and he starts buttering up the casting agents, like, can I get in quick? And it was Henry Winkler. And I thought, if the Fonz is still out here hustling like this, man, I got no business taking up the oxygen, because I just, you know, I. And so I had a couple pilots that just died. My wife got pregnant, and the talent couch scout from ABC called and said, we're starting Good Morning America weekend. And I was as shocked as anybody, because I thought, surely there's somebody in London, or like Chris Cuomo was going to get that job, who was there and was pissed when I got it. And I show up and I pretended to be, I did my imitation of Peter Jennings for a couple of years. But then I realized, hey, they hired me because of that tape in Chicago. And I just started infusing more myself into stuff. Diane Sawyer was a huge influence. He said, you know, something's happening in China. Why don't you go explain China to us? And just unlocked a world of international storytelling. I did Nightline, then I moved to CNN. When that same talent scout moved over, she brought some of us with her. And that's when the Wonderlist came about and the Climate Beat came about. So it is a very circuitous path. But I look back now, you know, when I was a sportscaster, I cringe at what I thought was funny about the world. I once made a joke about the Dodgers should scout in Gaza because the way those kids throw rocks, you know? And I cringe now, having been to places like that and met those kids and understand the world. So the more I traveled and the more the novelty of just being on TV wore off, the more I just wanted to tell stories that affect the most people, that you know, have the biggest, you know, stakes are the highest for most life on Earth. And for me, the climate, I'd resisted a beat my whole life. I didn't want to be pigeonholed, because I like everything, politics and entertainment, everything in between. But this is the beat that really includes all of the others. It's economics and it's foreign policy and it's energy and it's shelter and transportation. And I like to say we're all going to be climate reporters, kind of the way we all became health reporters during COVID.
Yeah, as I expected, that is a great story. Because there are so many steps along the way and how it all came together. Absolutely incredible. But the last thing I want to focus in on is how that role of chief climate correspondent came about. Was that someone at CNN that came to you suggesting this idea? Or was this something you had been thinking out about and you went to them? How did that come about?
No, it was by virtue of, I had done three seasons of my show, The Wonderlist. And then after the 2016 election, that changed this sort of the appetite. And we were living sort of tweet to tweet in the early days of the Trump presidency. And you know, I tried some other projects. We tried selling shows outside at the time, you know, to Apple and other streamers, because my boss who brought me here had built this mini studio. She had, you know, from Kamau Bell and Lisa Ling and Anthony Bourdain, we had all these original films and series, and I was part of that world. And when that sort of dried up, there was Rick Davis, who was the chief legal counsel here, who's an avid sort of fly fisherman and outdoorsman, was a big, would give me story ideas all the time about environmental pieces. He argued to my boss, Jeff Zucker, at the time, we need to create a climate desk, you know, and Weir should do it. And I kind of leapt at it. And now we've grown it to, we have, I think, 15 people now, you know, people in London and Dubai and producers and writers digitally. And I'm trying to get, like I said, everybody in the newsroom to think about how their beat or their assignment is affected by the climate story as well. But I'm proud to be at a place that takes the story seriously and leans into it.
Not every story is obviously a climate story, at least initially. But once you go past, you know, the facade and you go deeper and you see how it does impact things at different levels and at different magnitudes. And I want to talk a little bit more about that. We're going to take a little break and talk more about the things that you've seen out there, Bill. We're with Bill Weir, Chief Climate Correspondent at CNN on the Across the Sky podcast. We'll be right back.
Hey, Joe Martucci here, and this podcast is proudly sponsored by Weather Call Services. Don't be caught off guard by severe weather. Choose Weather Call. Receive precise, location-specific alerts via phone, text, or email. With over a decade of experience, WeatherCall delivers pinpoint accuracy for your exact address, ensuring no surprises. So take charge and stay prepared when ominous skies loom. Explore the WeatherCall difference today. Visit weathercallservices.com/lee-enterprises. That's weathercallservices.com/lee-enterprises. ENTERPRISES. We'll have that link in the show notes too. Safeguard yourself, your business, or any school that matters to you.
Bill, we talked a little bit about your career getting you to this point and the things that you've seen and how history, as we're living through it, has kind of changed perspective. I want to get back to one of these lines I read in a book where you're kind of addressing your son. You said, by then, you'll know whether or not the disenlightenment turned deadly and if the age of unreason broke like a fever and whatever happened to the president and the red hat. So, you know, my kids are a little older than yours, but I kind of have that same thing in my head. Like, what are they going to see? Kind of riff on that for a little bit, if you don't mind.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, he's, again, this was sort of written as a record of his early days on Earth. And sort of when I used as metrics, the day that you learn to open kitchen cabinets, I packed body armor and flew to my home state of Wisconsin to cover the inauguration because nobody knew what was going to happen after January 6th. And last time I had packed body armor was to go cover the war in Afghanistan. And the story had changed. Now, homegrown school shooters were a much bigger threat to my little boy and his future than my daughter when we worried about terror from overseas. You know, we live next door to the hole where the World Trade Centers were when we first moved to New York, right? And so that's just the way the story's changed, and the president in the red hat single-handedly has changed the story of democracy and the Republican Party and discourse, and it's just undeniable. And again, it gets back to the power. Stories are the most powerful things we have. And having moved around the country a lot, I had a very nomadic gypsy youth. I have best friends in red Oklahoma and bright blue Malibu. And I understand how they grew up and why they vote the way they do. And I try to hold grace for the story believers if the world around them, the ecosystem, is that worldview, you know? And so I don't... What I like to say is my daughter has this irrational fear of sharks. I don't blame her. I blame Steven Spielberg for making Jaws so convincing, you know, with two notes on a cello, that it scared a whole generation from this one sort of key species in our oceans. And I'd love to think that she's going to go scuba diving with me one day, but I know we're not going to get there by me calling her an idiot, you know? And so I have to meet her where her, with the information she's got. And so... The age of disenlightenment, the age of now book bannings and all this kind of stuff, I worry that the country will sort of balkanize into these regions of, you know, science or not. And I don't know. But I do think we have much more in common. And when I'm constantly surprised covering stories around the country, where I'll go into places where I know CNN is not their first news choice. But somebody will open a screen door and go, Bill Weir, man, I got to get a selfie with you, or, you know. And so people surprise you on all levels. And it doesn't help that we're talking to each other through virtual screens and avatars. We need to be back hugging and handshaking and working together in the sun. You know, that's how we evolved as a species. And we're so clever. We've invented these devices that just make life frictionless, but it also makes us lonely.
Yeah. So back to the in-person stuff that you've seen some things, some very cool things and some very tragic things, but let's talk about the positive stories. You know, those of us who have worked in the climate space for a while, solar and wind, as you alluded to, very inexpensive, but battery storage, that's always kind of been the missing link to be able to store this power. We're able to generate and then pull it back when it's needed, when demand is higher. You got a great story about rocks in a box in Fresno in terms of generating power, because so many times people are locked into, it's a huge lithium ion battery. We've got to mine lithium. That's nasty too. Tell us more about the rocks in a box.
Yeah. So this is a guy who was a public school student from Oregon who started this company called Antora. Sort of a genius kid who tinkered in the garage, loved solar, went to Stanford, started a company while at Stanford, came back, realized now we've got it. We actually harvesting the sun. It's super cheap and plentiful. We got to hold it, and looked at a lot of different ways to store it and came up with the thermal battery, which is when the first caveman moved a hot rock from next to the fire over to where he was sleeping, he invented the thermal battery. And heat as an energy storage, you don't think about your thermos having more energy than your cell phone battery or your hot water heater having energy that you can manage and harness. And he realized that if you take a big block of just pure carbon, which is super common material used in smelting already, and you build an insulated box around it and then just use abundant wind or solar to heat that sucker up, just like a toaster would with a coil, simple technology, they can heat that up to 2,500 degrees, enough to make steel or run a factory. And the fun thing is you can move that heat through liquid into, you know, and steam or however typically the old school factories, or you crack the box open like the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark, and the light that's beaming out of this thing is so bright, you catch it with another solar panel and you get heat and electricity. And he's got customers in the Midwest who want to use these to run factories off of Kansas wind or whatever. And the steam that exists in New York City is seeing all the movies that comes out of our streets. I didn't know. I have people would say, hey, what's that steam? I remember I heard this funny like tour guide on the double-decker buses go, that's where the smokers go. Since we had to ban smoking in the restaurants, they're underground. But it's actually the first biggest district heating system in the country, and it serves 3 million people, and it makes cheese in the village, and it climate controls the art at MoMA. And forever it's been made with dirty fuels. And now I like to think it soon could be made with a hot rock in a box, you know, heated up by a turbine off of Long Island. And so all of this is taking off. The question is whether we're going to replace the old dirty energy with this new stuff, or just use it to mint bitcoins or run AI questions. You know, like we seem to come up with ways to burn power faster than we come up with new clean ways to make it. And again, that comes back to the stories and how we think about our relationship with these things.
Yeah, and Bill, and speaking about the stories, you've covered so many, and I was just going through just the weather stories that you covered. And the two I want to hit on are, you covered Hurricane Katrina back in 2005, and then more recently, the Lahaina fires in just 2023. So I wanted to hit on those. You know, for me, Hurricane Katrina is the weather event. I was in high school at the time, and that grabbed my attention. And it's like, wow, look at just how many people can be impacted by a hurricane and how it can completely change so many people's lives. So that was the weather event that grabbed me and made me want to be a meteorologist. So can you talk about maybe a story from your coverage of Hurricane Katrina that stands out to you about that, and then also Lahaina?
Yeah, I was a Cub reporter, kind of at anchor at ABC, and they put me and a couple other guys, I can't remember who, Terry Moran was on there, on our flight, Bob Woodruff. And they flew into Baton Rouge. They'd closed the New Orleans airport. That was as close as we can get. So I rode out the storm in Baton Rouge live on the air with Charlie Gibson and Diane Sawyer. And then the next day, during the storm, we realized that ABC was the one network that didn't have a live truck in the city. We had these independent contractors, and they freaked out and like, we're not riding this out. And they left. And so we're up against all these other networks who had pictures from the Superdome as people were, you know, or on the overpass, that those legendary pictures. But we were surrounding New Orleans. It was sort of a race, super competitive, to try to get there. And I spent half a day trying to drive in, couldn't get past the blocks. We were about to hire a helicopter, and they shut the airspace. And I thought, if we could just get a boat, maybe we can go up the Mississippi and find this boat dealership in Gonzales, Louisiana. There was a truck in the parking lot. I humped the fence and bang on the door. And this guy answers with a big handgun because he thought I was a looter. I'm like, no, I'm just a reporter. We're looking for a boat. You know, I said, is there any way, do you have a boat you could take us into New Orleans? And he's like, well, we can't put on the Mississippi, but I can get you there. Hold on. And he goes back inside, and the garage door opens, and he backs out this brand new gleaming speedboat, like a, you know, with 350 horsepower, you know, gorgeous fiberglass. And he goes, I can get you there in this in an hour. We'll go through the swamps and cross Lake Pontchartrain. and it'll only be $110,000. And so I called the desk back in New York. Like, if I can be in New Orleans in an hour, can I expense a boat? Can I, is it possible for me to buy this boat? And they negotiated with him. So he took us in for 10 grand for an hour. And so we go screaming through the swamp, and we get to this one pass. It's a trestle bridge. And it was so eerie because we're going under it, and there was a recording going, danger, danger, bridge out. And we barely fit the tip of the windshield of the boat under this bridge because the water was so high in Lake Pontchartrain. And the captain's like, okay, if it gets any higher, we won't get out of here. So we're on the clock. So we go screaming across. We put in on the west end near the yacht club. And I knew New Orleans well. I dated a girl down there. And it was the most surreal thing getting off that boat. And the harbor was tossed like a toddler's bath time. And I wander in waist-deep water in the middle of Robert E. Lee Boulevard. An elderly woman screaming down at me for medicine and information. And this is 2 days after landfall. And that's when you start to realize the collision of natural and man-made disasters. The capacity not to imagine that, you know, Lake Pontchartrain wasn't rising at that point. It was going into the city because the levees had broken. And you think in terms of water time, especially in a place like New Orleans, we've been watching this storm come for a week. We're an hour from the beach. You know, once it's passed, we should be good. Not people dying in their homes days, you know, after the storm because of all of these poor design, poor planning. A lot of just unintended consequences waking us up. You know, when you build a city like that underwater, you know, it is below the level of the river and you're relying on pumps and ingenuity and the world around you is changing. I mean, that's where I met Russell Honoré for the first time, who I just interviewed last year. And he said, that was the first time anybody ever asked me about climate change. You know, it didn't occur to me standing there after Katrina. And now it is his main mission in life is climate activism. So that definitely shaped me. And then Lahaina was similar in that we lacked the capacity of imagination to think that 80 mile an hour hurricane force winds could throw embers like a, you know, like rain across this tinder dry grassland that had been altered by generations of just horrible mismanagement and water diversion. That was one of the luscious places in the world at one time. And the reports are just now, the Attorney General released her first phase of her report. The lessons are being learned there. Hopefully we'll teach a lot of communities to embrace their capacity. A lot of the criticism now was just old world thinking. You didn't staff up. You didn't have the communication. These are no longer your granddaddy's fires anymore. You know, as the earth changes, fires are getting bigger, more sudden, more. But I met a guy there, Archie Kalepa, who's a legendary waterman, lifeguard, big wave surfer, Hall of Famer. And he was running this do-it-yourself sort of relief center in the cul-de-sac neighborhood and with no government help at all, and had everybody's needs met. Water, food, medicine, information, love and esteem needs, music to lift spirits, cooking out, the aloha sense of community. While they were surrounded by ash and weren't sure what they were breathing, was just one of the most inspiring things. I end the book with talking about giving him props there. That's the kind of boy I want to raise. You know, that's the kind of community member I hope to see. And I hope we can all learn from these places as we rebuild, and not just the physical homes we live in, but the fabric of our communities.
Yeah, those are two great stories from the U.S., but I'm curious about your international travels. I mean,
you
travel all over the world in this role with CNN. And so I'm just going to ask you, what is the story that it grabs you the most of all the stories that you cover? Like, what is the one that stands out most in your mind for CNN, like outside of the U.S.?
Well, there are the ones that are kind of like Katrina, you know, going to war with the 1st Infantry, you know, up in the mountains of Afghanistan and seeing how they perform, or going into Japan after Fukushima and experiencing all of that. But there's a story I talk about in the book in that it encapsulates the fun of the Wonderlist. Was we had the opportunity to literally look at a map and say, I wonder what's happening in Madagascar. And I knew I wanted to do a story about tribes fighting progress and just trying to hold on to their cultures. And I saw this picture, beautiful picture, these two guys on top of a rock in the middle of the South Pacific and loincloths, bows and arrows. And I said, oh, I want to go there. And then I realized it was Vanuatu, which is middle of the South Pacific, this island nation, 82 little islands, very different cultures on each island. And they were taken by this photographer, Jimmy Nelson, who does this with these, you know, he just wants to glorify these indigenous people before they pass away, before, you know, they're swallowed by strip malls and modern living. And so we flew there, and it's the longest place I've ever had to go. A couple of days to get to this place, dugout canoe across the lagoon. The guy in the picture steps out of the jungle and he's wearing a Manchester United t-shirt and board shorts. And he's like, hey, I'm Bob. can I follow you on Facebook? And they were so well connected. The cell signal on top of the rock where they took that picture had stronger, you know, more cell signal than my apartment in Manhattan. But they were just all, the world had just been open to them. They didn't get television until, you know, 20 years before. And to learn about what they wanted. They wanted what we want. They wanted a flat screen TV and a nice road to take their kid to a hospital if it's needed, you know, and decent schools. And I was romanticizing how nice they had it with, you know, white sand and so much fish and fruit and abundance and no antidepressants and all this. And it really got me thinking about wants and needs and the stories we tell ourselves. Bob, you know, I said, so what do you, you know, these are subsistence fishermen. But since people started coming to this island, he wanted to be an actor. You know, he wanted to be like me in L.A., you know, auditioning. He wanted to be a movie star. And because the story around him had changed and opened him up to all these other possibilities. And it makes me think about, you know, he just was hoping to go up and pose for these pictures, get a few bucks to buy the nails to build his house. And how he fills his pyramids and needs are so different than mine. Our kids, I try to tell them, you have it so good relative to the folks I meet. And as a result, you have a responsibility to help those folks and those around you appreciate these things. But it mostly made me realize we are so connected. Like there are no places left where somebody, you can walk up and blow their minds by showing them an iPhone. It's just, we are now more connected than ever. The question is, whether we'll connect with each other, you know, get on the same page about our shared planet and a way to run the economy that doesn't destroy it. And that story is going to be the big one, I think, for the rest of my life.
I would tend to agree with that. I mean, there's not a lot, if none, in terms of a sociological precedent for this level of communication with so many people across the world simultaneously. So there is so much positive opportunity there. Unfortunately, with any kind of technology, it can be used positively or negatively.
Exactly. Yeah.
Before we let you go, are there one or two things that you kind of wish people here in the States could see? That maybe there is somebody in North Dakota or in Wyoming or in rural West Virginia that you really wish they could see to help them understand the world around them. So many people in the middle part of the country, and these are good people, all right? So many times they kind of get picked on, but these are good, you know, salt of the earth people. What would you show them or try to kind of explain to them about what's going on in the world around them that maybe they just don't get a chance to see?
Yeah, I think that, you know, my experience at ABC, when I was actually given a mission of going and explaining places to the world and took the great responsibility with that, it changed the way I travel. And then I'm the annoying dad who, when we're, you know, at a beach somewhere on an island, to say, so what do you do when we're not here? What was it like before we showed up? You know, tell me about your favorite spot where the tourists don't know. I don't want to go there. I just want to appreciate this place as a local and what you do, you know, and honor your place in it. And everybody has that sense of pride wherever you guys live. I know I do, my neighborhood, you know, that you cherish a place and you know the threats to it and you hoped other people could see it the same way you do. And so I would ask folks, you know, and a lot of times I used to say this all the time with the Wonderlist, I'm so lucky that I get to cast a far and wide net. But you can create a wonder list in your own state, in your county, to go to places that you normally wouldn't go and talk, you know, and visit a farmer's market you wouldn't normally go to, or find a waterfall you've always read about and not plugged into. I'm really just hoping folks lean across the fence, especially in an election year, and connect over the shared values of the fishing hole they love or the hiking trail that's nearby. And I wish, I guess, to answer your question, is just whether it is literally putting your knees under a table, and I've done it, from Iceland to Gaza to South Africa to Bhutan. These folks are so much more just like you. They have the same sense of humor, same worries about their kids. Their diets may be odd or whatever compared to yours. But that if you lean in and just say, hey, man, what's your story? That can lower a lot of defenses, lower the temperature, and enlighten you about folks. And you don't walk away maybe agreeing on everything, but and I'm of the place, like, if you got a better idea on how for us to do stuff, bring it. I'd love to learn from you, and here's what I've learned. And I don't know if that answers the question. It's not very pat, but it's so easy to self-isolate these days. And the more we can get our kids and ourselves out in with each other in nature, the better.
And Bill, the last thing I want to ask you is, anytime we have somebody on the podcast talking about climate change, I think the most common question I get is, you know, people feel overwhelmed by this climate change story, you know, and it makes you feel so small. You know, It's something that's impacting so many people across the world. And so the question I get is, like, what can I really do as one person to help solve this problem? So I'm going to ask that to you. If somebody came to you and said, what can I do to help solve this problem, this global warming problem, what would you tell them? What is something that one person can do?
My answer to that is, what do you love? What are you good at? You know, are you good at throwing parties and raising some money? Well, I know some boots on the ground conservation folks who could really use a donation. Like, are you good at, do you like to be outdoors? Because there are some volunteer groups that are doing some planting or bringing back some mangroves. Or, you know, are you an accountant? Can you lend those skills to the bird conservation group that you, shared admiration for? Are you a driven entrepreneur? Do you want to celebrate, like, if you want to get in as an investor? Are you an investor? Get in on these thermal battery companies, you know, like, just use what you got maybe to move things 5% for the better. And that's the thing we tend to get in, like, what is my composting? What is it going to matter? It matters, because you are breaking a tradition of taking certain things for granted. You're starting a new tradition. Maybe you'll nerd out on it. Maybe you'll become the best composter on your block. Does that matter in the grand scheme of things when we're still giving $1 trillion subsidies to oil companies? No, but I think absolutely matters to you and your family, your sense of well-being, your mental health, your sense of agency. And if we stop thinking about it as a thing and more just like, okay, this is a new reality, and I have to think about shelter different. So, oh, we got a renovation coming up. We can finally build our dream, you know, extension. How are we going to do it in a way that makes more sense for the planet too? You know, like, just asking, it doesn't have to be radical. And the thing about the messaging around this story for so long is the nightmare. Dr. King said, I have a dream. You know, you got to picture the possibilities of it. And the idea of the worst case scenario, you go through this effort, is your immediate neighborhood is healthier and more connected and stronger for whatever storm might be coming next. And I think by turning that anxiety into action, it's better for our mental health as well. And of course, be civically engaged, you know, be a voter, be a pest to your favorite brand, you know, email, I love your brand. What's your climate plan? That registers with them more than you think more than you know. And I think more good is going to be done at, like, local public utility meeting levels than at the Paris Climate Accords in some ways. You know, if you want to do volunteer work, maybe one way to do it is to go to those meetings to understand why they're choosing the energy sources of your community or the water boards and understand the challenges there, and then sharing that information with your neighbors. That's not nothing. That's a lot, you know, and I love the impulse. And again, and maybe most of all, just talk about it. Figure out a way to you don't have to say, aren't you scared about climate change? You know, that's the reason people stay away from it. It could be conversations at drop off at school. Hey, you know, I just read this thing about electric school buses. Wouldn't it be cool if our kids, you know, weren't breathing these fumes and then they could plug the school into the bus's battery at night? You know, wouldn't that be something? Talk about it. Because until we start just getting it out into the story, until we change the story, nothing's going to change.
Such good advice. Catherine Hayhoe at the Nature Conservancy says the same thing. The most important thing we can do is simply talk about it and share our shared values, if you will.
Yes,
Bill, the book
yes.
is Life as We Know It Can Be: Stories of People, Climate, and Hope in a Changing World. Wear it out. The book is out now, by the way, everybody. Go get the thing. So where else can people find your work, Bill?
Well, you can see me on CNN. You know, most days I'm popping up here and there, giving the news a day. I'm working on a special around the themes of the book that will air this sometime this summer on the whole story with Anderson Cooper. And it'll be about these adaptation ideas I'm finding, how it's changing construction and all kinds of things. And I'd love to hear what your audience thinks about the book too. So if you drop a review in Goodreads or Amazon, I'm going to read them. I'd love to hear your honest thoughts. And I really appreciate the kind words and smart conversation from you guys. Thank you so much.
Absolutely, Bill. Take care. Good luck with the book, man.
Thank you.
Wow, that dude can tell a story. Some of those things are just riveting. You know, there are places I hope to visit someday to kind of see them. But he is, you know, deep in it, thick in it, and been to places I can only imagine. So it was really good to hear those comments from him.
Yeah, I loved listening to him. I hope the audience does too. I just asked the question and let him go. You know, I didn't even need to ask a follow-up because he just had, it was amazing all the details that he was able to write, even for stuff that happened a long time ago, Hurricane Katrina. That just listening to that story, I did have a good laugh about the guy who won $100,000 to take him into New Orleans. Got him down to 10,000, a little bit more reasonable. But yeah, I'm envious in a way. I know, I mean, clearly, I'm sure it's been hard on his family going to all these places and traveling, being away from home so much. But I'm a little bit envious in some ways because he's seen so much and met so many people and has so many stories. He is absolutely a guy that you just could talk to all day long, buy him a beer and just let him go. Tell me about all the places you've seen and all the people you've met.
Yeah, so that book is out now, conveniently for Earth Day, Life as We Know It Can Be, Stories of People, Climate, and Hope in a Changing World. I've started reading it, and I've really kind of taken to it. So I'm going to hopefully, that's at the top of my list. I'm trying to do multiple books at once. We'll see how that goes. But, you know, with summer now right around the corner, we've got some good summertime, springtime, summertime stuff in the works. Chris Pegaski will be back with us next week to talk about lightning, Jason Oaken to talk about flash drought. Flash drought is a term that I only learned about 3 or 4 years ago. You know, we've heard about flash flooding, but what's a flash drought? And then we'll still have Jen Carfagno later on in the spring. We're planning for around Memorial Day to talk to her. So lots of good stuff coming up in the coming weeks. Anything else from you this week, Matt?
Now, I think we're going to get some good stories from Jen, too. Another person who's seen a lot of places, covered a lot of stories, so I'm looking forward to her coming on.
Yeah, everything from Punxsutawney Phil to massive amount of snow in the Sierra Nevada Ridge. So we will wrap it up for this week for Matt Hollander in Chicago and in absentia, Joe Martucci in Atlantic City, Kirsten Lang in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I'm meteorologist Sean Sublett. Thanks for listening to the Across the Sky podcast, and we will talk with you next week.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.